So, Smith, he mentioned some specific idols. To be honest with you, he kind of felt like these were the things he struggles with.
Yeah.
But nothing wrong with that, but there's obviously a lot of other things. He mentions the idols of approval, comfort, power. And there's plenty of other things. Now, these are kind of like characteristics, or I don't know how to describe them, but big picture items, not specific little things like we talked about, like the little assumptions, but even some of those are based in some of these. So what are some of our idols? That's a good question for us to ponder and think about. What are the things, as I've heard someone say before, I want to say it was an old time evangelist, you know, it's a thing that you'll sin to get, or it's a thing that you'll sin if you don't have it, the sin that you'll sin to get it, or sin if you don't have it. I forget how it says it, but it's something that makes you sin. I cannot. I'm so tongue-tied trying to think of that daggum saying. So we're just going to skip that part.
Lord, I think it's in the book. Like, that concept sounds familiar, like I read it.
I feel like the older I get, the different my idols look. So, like, what he was talking about, like, the convenience thing, I'm like, oh, I completely identify with that. You know, the idol of convenience. Like, I don't want to be inconvenienced in my old set ways. You know what I mean? I'm really not that old, but I'm just saying, like, the older I've gotten, I'm just like,
yeah,
I don't like to be inconvenienced. I like to have control and don't upset the flow, you know, kind of thing. So I feel like even in life, some of those idols kind of change.
So what's an example of how the idol of convenience comes at us? Or how do we recognize that? Because I can totally identify with the idol of control.
Well, like for me, it's just like, for instance, I have something on my agenda today, like a weekend, and I want to get something done. Of course, I haven't told anybody that's what I'm going to get done. And then it's like, somebody wants to do something completely different. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like, you know what I mean? Because in my mind, and I didn't voice it to anybody, I've just already set in my mind that that's what I want to do. And how dare y'all come up with some other kind of alternative plans?
I'm big time that. I do not like, the thing that it'll ruin my week is if there's something going on one evening that I don't want to do. Like a PTA meeting or something. I'm just like, please don't.
Like a totally unnecessary thing that kills the whole afternoon.
Yeah. It does, because I cannot. My thing is, like, my idol is I want to end my day on my terms. Mm-hmm. I do not want to end my day, like, running or hassle or doing something like that. I want to end my day chill and relax and just kind of fade into the evening. So anything that's coming up in the evening, even if it's a good thing, it's like, just got amped up. So, yeah, I don't like evening things at all. Even Wednesday nights are like, I'm tense on Wednesday, I'm all day, I'm like, oh God, Wednesday. Yeah, just get going ready for tonight. Just gotta go in. And I'm thinking the whole day about the night. It's just one of those weird things about me. When I was a pastor in that little church and we had evening service on Sundays, I was a wreck until the amen of the last service on Sunday. I just was tense the whole day. I couldn't hardly stand it. But, so that was one of my idols. But I'm gonna talk to you about something. Idols is one of those things we could hammer on that and talk about it, but I think something that we kind of can do on our own, thinking about the things that are in our lives that will cause us to mistreat someone else or to be selfish, you know, something that we want or something that we like or something that we feel like we earned or demand or need even. And we'll talk about some of those examples as we go through, but page 31, he says something that kind of tripped me off to thinking about something else. I don't see the quote there, but I thought I highlighted it. But anyway, I've written it down. He talks about his journey to the heart of the problem. And the journey to the heart of the problem was one of those just phrases that just like took me off on a totally different tangent. And I thought, you know, it's something if we don't get to it later on in the book, I'm going to say it right now. And it was a quote that made me think about one of the best books on marriage that I've ever read. It was actually a parenting book. And you would think, well, that sounds pretty condescending, what do you mean? But But really, it was the thought of the book, and the book is Shepherding a Child's Heart, because it really laid out a really strong and a clear application of a biblical counseling principle, which is just simply that when people come to you for counseling, which, you know, I've been in that position some, and even if you're not a counselor, people come to you with issues and problems all the time. And there's what counselors call a presenting problem, right? Which is, why I'm here. Like, I come to you because, but it's almost never the root of the issue, right? There's something deeper that's the root. Most of the time, some people know it. And so what we have here is a situation where most of the time we have a presenting problem. And the presenting problem could be something like, I'm mad because my spouse wants me to do projects all Saturday. And that just sucks. I don't want to do it. I'm tired. And what's the presenting problem? Well, she never leaves me alone. She just nags me all the time. She's just busting my chops, doesn't let me rest, doesn't understand how hard I work. That's the presenting problem. That's what you say is the problem. You know, and I'm just skirting over a lot of what you would have to do to get to this point, but we're just saying, what do we find out at the end? This is the real issue. The real issue would be something like, maybe I am lazy. That's a real issue. Maybe I don't want to work, or maybe I'm being selfish. I just want to protect my time. Or maybe it's not a bad thing at all. Maybe it's not something that's evil. Maybe it's something like, I'm super tired, and I would rather take a mental break, a physical break, than accomplish something today. But I've just not talked to you about that because I haven't really thought about it in those terms. I just thought about you nagging me. And instead of talking about it, now. It's fine. But instead of talking about it, I'll pout because you didn't read my mind and know what I was thinking already, right? This is the problem. Or the presenting problem, she comes home and there's dishes in the sink. What's the presenting problem? He's a slob, the house is a wreck, now I have to come home. I've worked all day and I just want to crash, but now I have to come home and work at home too. That's a presenting problem. What's the actual problem deep down? Could be a lot of things, but maybe it's something like, man, I just feel like a slave. I feel like they just sit at home waiting for me to come home and clean the house. I don't feel valued. I feel taken advantage of. I feel like my contributions are valued. I feel like I'm taken for granted. And I've not really communicated those feelings. So what I assume is done on purpose. I assume you understand that. You're just being a jerk. Even if I can't articulate these feelings myself, that's the way I feel, right? So these are kind of some of the ways we can get at the idols, the ways we can get to the heart of the issues. There's always a really rudimentary problem laid at the core of it. You know, when you strip everything bare, I have never in my entire life, and I don't think I ever will, because I've seen how it works. And there's always an incredibly simple issue at the core. It's never complicated. It might seem, the outworkings might look complicated, but it's always something like, I wanted something and I didn't get it. That's usually the culprit, things like that. Or, I don't feel appreciated. It's usually something very, very simple like that. So when we're trying to work through problems and issues in marriages or in relationships, talking about what's happening is good, but it's an opportunity for us to dig down and see, like, okay, what's the real issue? You know, the house, I'm mad now. Okay, I got it. You want me to clean the house? No, that's not it. Well, what do you want me to do? I said, yeah. Then it's this kind of a, ultimately you have to do the work and dig and say, you know what? I feel like you just don't appreciate me. Then that's a new discussion. But idols, likewise, are heart issues. It's the same kind of thing. We covet, we desire, we seek out to the neglect of better things and to our own detriment these things, these idols. It's things that we look for that we can't be without, or we don't think we can. So verse 32 talks about kind of the outworkings of what, page 32, what that looks like, what happens. And this section is called Round and Round, and it's a really just kind of a what-if scenario. I mean, I think it happened to him, but not anything inspired, but I think it's true in general. This is typically what happens. There is a cyclical nature. There is a downward spiralish kind of nature to sin in a relationship. You know, when one person sins, the other person's response is at best hindered, right? It's not helped. And unless somebody takes the initiative to reverse the flow, it tends to go down in a spiral and get worse and worse. And if you're, you know, if you've been married for a while and you've done this before, maybe you can, you know where to draw the line, but it's still not getting any better. It's just like, okay, that's too far. I can't go, you know. We know where to stop, but that might be the best case scenario. And that's what happened here in this case. I think it's a good illustration that he gave, and I'm going to tell you one in a minute. Where am I at? Oh, let me back up here a little bit. So I know it sounds like the opposite of what you should do on page 32 here. He says, focusing on your spouse's faults can be a real trap, but you need to realize that you didn't marry a perfect person. Oxymoron here, kind of a thing that's like both true and not true at the same time. It doesn't seem like you should do it, which is you'd ought not to focus on your spouse's faults, but at the same time, you really need to be aware that your spouse has flaws. And I know it sounds obvious, but what we mean to say is, how can you expect that person to never sin? Like, we act like you sinned. You really dropped the ball this time. You did it. You weren't perfect today. How dare you? You know, because we don't recognize that, like, they have flaws. They don't have a superpower that they just turn on and can be perfect. And when they get around us, they're like, nope, don't feel like it. I'm just going to be rude. Yeah, we don't do that. But we often kind of feel like it, like they could help this. And they can to some degree. But what I'm saying is, we don't give our spouses, we should give our spouses more grace, recognizing she's not perfect, he's not perfect, I can't expect him to be perfect. You know, we challenge one another to grow, but when we see a flaw, a sin, and to say, you know, that's the last straw, you know, where I would never do that. We need to be willing to give grace and mercy to realize our spouses are flawed. And think of one simple thing. And this is something that helps me, and I don't know if it's the way Jesus would do it, but it's the way we do it. You know, he's a different kind of being, but I think about this. Do you hold yourself to the same standard that you would hold your spouse to? Do you hold yourself to the same standard? I think what we tend to do is we tend to say, well, I didn't really mean to say that. And then what we're saying is, my sin is okay because, well, I was in a hurry or I was upset. Really, it was her fault anyway. She pushed me into it. And so my sin's not a big deal, but I cannot believe that she said that to me. Right? This is the kind of thing of like where I can kind of gloss over my own sin because I know in my heart I didn't really mean it or I was kind of angry. But I hold my spouse to a different standard. Like, how dare they? It's a simple way for me to forgive my spouse over here. It's just to think about my own sin. As I said, that doesn't work for Jesus, but that works for us, right? A simple way is just to reflect on, not in a kind of a self-deprecating sense, but in a realistic sense, like how bad I am. I'm not that great. I've probably done what they did before. Colossians 3:13 says, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And it's a really simple thing. You think about how the Lord forgives us, but I think about, you know, how my own spouse has forgiven me. And there are times when I'm in the middle, Kyle doesn't know this because it's just things that happen in my own heart sometimes. Be in the middle of something and being rude or being a jerk about something, and like I will think about the times that she's forgiven me for that before and just be really just humiliated to think that like I'm holding her to the standard that like I can't forgive her for that. She's forgiven me for something just like that or more than that. And yet I'm angry now about this. I've done a complete 180 from feeling wronged to feeling ashamed. Just thinking like, I'm mad about this, and she forgave me for that, you know, or I've done this and I've been forgiven. And then all of a sudden the thing that you're angry about becomes smaller and smaller in the light of our own forgiveness, what we've experienced. Not just from God, I think that can seem kind of distant, like, you know, the Lord has forgiven us, and it seems just so monumental, it's really hard to wrap our arms around, like, to me, a way to apply that in the moment, like, yes, God forgave me for 9 bajillion sins. You know, it's just like an unrealistic, it's an unfathomable sort of forgiveness. True and overwhelming, but in this moment, to me, it's the small things like, oh yeah, I've done the same thing or something similar or something worse. And this is what I was getting at earlier, jumped ahead of myself. Kind of going back and forth here, there is a cyclical, a kind of a self-feeding sort of a nature of self-centeredness and idol worship in marriage. And page 30, Smith talked about how he drove his wife to feel like she needed to withdraw. You know, that was the thing he said. When they were fighting, her defense mechanism was to withdraw. And the thing they were fighting about at the core of it was his need to feel the center of attention. He wanted to be, he wanted to have the attention. He wanted to be loved, liked, have approval. So as she withdrew, he felt ignored and kind of discarded. And so that made him angrier. He lashed out more, which caused her to withdraw more, which made him feel more angry. You know, so it's this cycle that keeps perpetuating. Years ago, I talked to a young man. I didn't talk to both of them. I talked to the young man, and I know what was going on because it's kind of common. But it was personal because I knew him pretty well. The husband and wife were both feeling trapped by their spouse. I'm getting this from the husband's perspective, and he's saying to me that she's suffocating me. And like, she's not letting me go. And she's crying because like I'm leaving, and he's an outdoorsy kind of guy. He likes hunting, fishing, hiking, boating, you know, and she was a stay-at-home mom with several kids. And so it went like this. He would put on his hiking boots and go out on a hike somewhere by himself. She would see him leaving and, you know, where are you going? You're leaving me with the kids. And in her mind, in her words, didn't want to be with the family. Right? He was avoiding the family, avoiding her specifically. What's wrong? Why don't you want to be with me? And the pressure began to ramp up because the more that she clung to him, the more he felt strangled and stifled, and the more he tried to get away. And so it almost tore their marriage apart, and it was a really simple thing that was, they both just needed a little perspective. There was nothing wrong. He didn't hate her. He wasn't trying to avoid her. You know, he was just a kind of a person that needed to recharge his batteries with a little solitude. And she was the kind of person that valued quality time, and she was, I'm sure there's a better, more polite way to say it, but clingy. She liked him to be around and thought that's what she valued. You know, this is what my dad was. He sat on the couch every night with some watch TV, and he didn't go out to the shop, or he didn't go fishing on Saturday morning. He was here with us. And so it was pretty simple. She needed to recognize his need for space and seclusion at times, let him go hiking alone, without feeling threatened that he was leaving or distancing himself on purpose from the family, that he was didn't want to be at home. And he needed to recognize her need for closeness and intimacy of space, the fact that he would just need to be near if he was at home and be available, and to realize that when he did leave, it was difficult on her, and you know, to minimize those things. And both of them needed to realize that, you know, him leaving wasn't because he didn't like spending time with the family. You know, so there was just this cyclical nature to it. And it was one of those things of just kind of a hidden expectation, and really, you know, not a bad thing, but both of them were sort of kind of making these things idols. Yeah, I need you here and I need to be alone. And you can see that when, that's why I kind of shy away from calling it an idol sometimes, because I don't think these are evil things or bad things necessarily. Sometimes they are, but if it's not an evil thing, then we kind of tend to say, well, you know, it's not an idol, there's nothing wrong with it. But it can still do some damage. These sorts of things can do damage. The last thing, what was it? The last thing in this chapter. Close to it anyway. No, not yet. Second one. Worship changes you. So this is an old principle, tale as old as time.
So real quick, before we get away from the cyclical thing,
okay,
was that last example an example of an idol or a communication gap or both? And what was the more takeaway? What do I need to take away from that example?
Well, I think, you know, let's just say, to use the word idol loosely, but not be afraid of it. So I think it was both. Because it was a good thing, or an amoral thing at least, but it became something that they were willing to hurt another person over. You know, she was willing to accuse him of leaving the family, and he was willing to accuse her of suffocating me. And they both felt personally threatened because they couldn't get what they wanted. Even though it was a natural kind of desire, you know what I mean? So it was both things. It was something that was normal, natural, elevated to an idol, I think, in this case. And I think that's kind of the progression that happens. And there might be some things there might be things in our lives that are, you know, kind of quote unquote idols we never address because they're never challenged. If I'm married to somebody that likes to do the same things I like to do, you know, let's just say Kylie and I both loved hang gliding. It was just like something we loved. And we were going to spend money on it. We were going to drop kids with the parents for 2 weeks and go hang gliding. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's going to be something she and I both would agree on. Like, if we couldn't have this, like, I wouldn't want to be alive, or I would, you know, if you didn't let me do this, I'd find somebody else. And she's like, yeah, you too. And, you know, we're just never challenged on it. But it could be an idol that's there, it's just not challenged. But in this case, this rears its head because, you know, it causes difficulty. In a way, that's a good thing. It's part of what, you know, marriage shapes us and molds us by, kind of rubbing against the raw places, I think.
Well, I think, too, a lot of times, like you're using an example of the girl, like, it's what she grew up with. Like, her dad did this, so she had this expectation of him that this is what he was going to be like for, you know.
Yeah.
So
precedent is powerful.
And it becomes, yes, like I said, it becomes an idol, even though it's not a bad thing.
I was just telling Woody the other night, I was like, you know what, all couples should go through a year of counseling their first year.
Yeah, we were talking about
it. We were reminiscing just like on our, like, you know, like when we were first married and stuff. I mean, it was helpful because he was going through counseling courses and stuff at seminary and stuff, so he's kind of like our own counselor. But I was like, you know what? Like,
that's a conflict of interest in your counseling.
I was like, you know what? I was like,
it really was.
You know what? Counseling your first year of marriage, you know?
Well, that's, you know, we were discussing how it seems like a silly thing, but most people, if they do get some kind of counseling, because they had a marriage.
Yeah, pre-marriage.
Which is good.
Yeah, but you don't really know anything then.
But then after you get married,
you just have expectations. You're like, do you want to
kind of left to hang out and drunk?
Sure.
I think it should be like year five.
At 5 years?
Yeah, like year one,
you're still figuring things out.
Everybody's just glad to be here.
You know, the rose colored glasses.
I think I think, you know, definitely the first few